Hello all, this is Kimberly Adams. Welcome to Make Me Smart, where none of us is as smart as all of us.
I'm Kyle Rosendahl. It's Tuesday. We're doing a single topic today, and that topic is inflation. Everybody's talking about it. We're all living it. Nobody really knows what the what. And so we're going to talk about it a little bit today because it's, I'm just going to say this. It is the economic issue of the day. How about that? Does that sound fair?
Yeah, totally okay. Fair. Right. I mean, as you well know, there are a lot of people in my family who don't necessarily tune in to a lot of economic news, but even they're asking me about this. And a lot of you have been writing in with questions. And so we want to get to some of those today, along with our own questions, with our guest, Victoria Guida. She's covered the Fed at Politico. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back on. It's always a good time.
Oh, I'm so glad. We like to have a party. Yeah. Okay, Victoria, it seems like the Fed, the markets, just about everyone suddenly started getting worried about inflation. Like, there were sort of rumblings of, you know, we need to watch out for inflation leading up to it. But last week, it just kicked into high gear. Why?
Yeah, so, I mean, inflation, as you all know, has been an issue that's been percolating for over a year now. We've seen heightened inflation. But, you know, I think people were sort of hoping that March and April would mark the peak of inflation. You know, we saw some of the after effects of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, particularly the really big spike in oil prices. And so people were sort of hoping that, you know, prices wouldn't rise as rapidly going forward and that we would start to see inflation sort of steadily come down. So when the Consumer Price Index report on Friday, and this was now a little over a week ago, that basically showed that inflation wasn't really slowing, including in what they call core inflation, which is excluding food and energy that's more volatile. So that kind of freaked people out because it showed that we're not necessarily through the worst of this. So it wasn't that people were sort of expecting inflation to end all of a sudden, but you kind of want to see that you're on a good trend. And, you know, that was sort of the big thing that really freaked people out.
The other thing that happened that Friday, and Powell talked about this in his press conference, was that they got some data about inflation expectations perhaps changing. Could you help folks understand why what we think is going to happen with inflation matters so much?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. So the University of Michigan puts out a survey every month that sort of measures consumer sentiment. One of the things they look at is what people expect out of inflation. And basically what that showed is people expect inflation to be higher. And the reason why that matters is because the economy is basically just sort of a word for the combination of everyone's behavior. And so when people expect inflation, that can sometimes be sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy where people maybe buy stuff now because they're worried the prices are going to go up later. And then maybe, you know, businesses raise prices more because they think they can or they think that they'll have to because they're worried about, you know, input costs going up. And so, you know, that was one of the reasons why we saw the Fed do, you know, a bigger rate hike than they were originally expecting. It wasn't just because they wanted to get interest rates up faster. It was also sort of a, you know, a message to the American public, hey, we're really serious about getting inflation back down. So, you know, don't get it into your heads that inflation's going to stay this high forever.
At the Federal Reserve and, you know, in academia more broadly, you have some of the really, really smart economists who thought that things were going to be better by now. Why is it so hard for the Fed and, you know, lots of other folks to predict the magnitude to which we would experience inflation and how long it would last?
Yeah, well, part of what's been so strange about this inflationary period is that the story hasn't exactly been the same the whole time. You know, so we first started to see inflation creep up starting in April 2021. And the reason for that was because you had these really key sectors like, you know, used cars, where prices were surging because there was a semiconductor shortage. And so the Fed just kind of thought, okay, this is a temporary, you know, supply issue that isn't necessarily indicative of a larger inflation problem in the economy, and we just need to kind of wait for that to get resolved. And, you know, you heard a lot of that. This was the whole transitory conversation where basically they thought that the supply chain issues were the things that were driving inflation, and those are things that would eventually get worked out. So one is that didn't happen, right? Like, supply chains have slowly gotten better, but there's still huge problems. That was the big thing. The second was they seemed to really underestimate the extent to which there was going to be sort of a demand side problem of people spending more than usual. And so, you know, this is where it comes into the whole question of, you know, was there too much government aid? I'm not an economist, so I can't say exactly, but I think it's fair to say that, you know, that government aid sort of supported higher levels of spending. And so, while the Fed was sort of seeing all these supply issues, they maybe underestimated the extent to which there was also demand side issues. And then the final piece, as I sort of mentioned a second ago, was Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which, you know, maybe until early in this year, you wouldn't necessarily have seen the signs of that coming. And until it happened, it wasn't totally clear that it was going to happen. And that led to a price, a spike in the price of oil, which, oil affects the prices of pretty much everything. It's how much it costs to transport things. It's how much it costs to make things, and it's gas, all of that. And then, you know, it also led to a huge spike in the price of food. So, I think that we had these sort of, and then COVID, right? Like, there were lockdowns in China. So you basically had an initial problem, and then you sort of layered on all of these other things going, you know, each successive, you know, quarter of the year, there's like new things that are happening. So partially it was a miscalculation on the part of the Fed, and partially it's just that, things are so uncertain right now that it was kind of hard to predict everything that actually happened.
Boy, that was a long list.
there's a lot that's been going on, right? Okay, so let's do a little audience participation. Juan Carlos, do me a favor, hit this question from Chris, would you?
Hi, this is Chris from North Haven, Connecticut, and hoping you can make me smart about the reaction to the inflation numbers last week. The Fed's most drastic rate hikes came just recently, so shouldn't we expect it to take a little more time for the effects to be realized? Are we jumping to panic prematurely? Thanks.
Jumping to panic, strong word. Victoria, what do you think?
Yeah, so I will give a nerdy answer to this question, which is,
kind of answer.
So it's actually kind of complicated to say how quickly the Fed's rate hikes are going to affect, you know, what they call real economic activity. And part of the reason is that the Fed not only raises interest rates, but it also communicates about how much it expects to raise interest rates in the future. And so one of the things that it did last week was to not only raise interest rates faster, but also say that they're ultimately going to end up at a higher place. And the reason why that matters is because markets, you know, stocks, bonds, investors, lenders, really start factoring in the endpoint of where the Fed's going to go once they feel like they have a sense of that. And so it doesn't just matter what the Fed has already done. It matters what investors think they're going to do. And so, there's a saying that people like to quote. I think it's from Milton Friedman, the monetary policy acts with long and variable lags. Mm-hmm. But that was because the Fed used to operate in a world where it would just raise rates and not tell anybody, and then it would sort of become obvious.
That's my favorite part. They used to not tell anybody. And I'm like, really? You can do that?
It does seem very strange. Like, reporters had to just sort of look at the market and figure out what was happening and how much they had raised rates by. And we operate in a very different world today. And so, where I'm going with all of that is the impact of the Fed's rate hikes might be felt a lot faster than you would think. But it's not like, you know, inflation is expected to come down immediately to the Fed's 2% target. It might take a year or two. So this will be sort of a more gradual process. In terms of jumping to panic, I mean, it's possible that's what's happening, given that we are seeing still significant supply side issues, and it's unclear how much the Fed actually can do through its tools versus just like, we need to make more stuff and get it to where it's going faster.
Yeah.
We have another listener question, but I want to first, Victoria, latch onto something you said where you were saying, you know, the Fed is operating in a very different environment now than we used to, not just in terms of how it communicates interest rate hikes, but in terms of the economy that we're in. And I wonder if the Fed even has the right tools anymore and the right playbook to handle this inflation that we have right now in a meaningful way, because as you just laid out in your list a little bit ago, the inflation's coming from all sides, but the response is, you know, the same.
Yeah, well, so the problem is it's really hard to separate out how much of this inflation is from supply and how much of it is from demand, right? Like how much of it is just we're spending more than we need to be and how much of it is just we're spending a normal amount and not enough stuff is being produced quickly enough. And it's also those things are interrelated, right? So if we demand more stuff, theoretically, people will make more stuff to try and meet what we're doing. And so you can actually raise, the total production in response to demand to a certain point. And so what the Fed worries about is, everyone points to the 1970s as an example of when we last had really intense inflation. And part of that was supply shocks. We had a lot of supply shocks at that time. And so I think part of the worry is that even if a lot of this inflation is being caused by the supply side, that changes, you know, what we were talking about earlier, this psychology of the consumer, of the business, that they're going to expect inflation. And so I think what the Fed is trying to do is, you know, combat the demand side of the problem to the extent that they can, and then also sort of counteract a little bit the psychological reaction to some of the supply side inflation. But you really do risk, damaging some healthy economic activity and putting a lot of people out of work and all of that if you go farther than the demand side really requires. And so, it's a really tricky balance where basically the Fed wants to bring inflation back down, but they're not necessarily going to know when to stop just by looking at the inflation data, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. All right. So that's the Fed's toolkit. Talk to me for a second about Congress and more to the point, President Biden, since he's the one under most of the political pressure. What tools do they have, if any, to do anything about this?
Yeah, so this is, you know, all the supply side issues that we've been talking about. It would be sort of finding ways to improve supply chains, make them more resilient, incentivize production. There's been a lot of talk about whether the Biden administration should be doing more to get domestic oil companies to produce more, because oil companies, generally have the capacity, but they need sort of the price incentive, because the worry there is that if they ramp up production and all of a sudden, you know, prices plummet, they might lose money. And so, there's a lot of talk about whether the Biden administration can sort of counteract that that fear from oil companies, although that could be politically complicated given climate change and all of that. And then, you know, things like the semiconductor shortage. I mean, there's longer term fixes that Congress and the executive branch can do. But in the short term, they can't really do much. And this is why it really falls so much to the Fed to get things headed back in the right direction.
Okay, so all the talk of inflation kind of naturally, and the Fed's response to it, has kicked off also all these predictions of whether or not we're going to end up in a recession, and can the Fed really engineer the soft landing, or are we going to end up in a recession? We got a listener question about recessions, and this is from Nick.
Hi, Make Me Smart. This is Nick from Minneapolis. You all have talked about how consumer spending is driving inflation these days. I remember right after 9/11 how President Bush talked about the need for Americans to spend more to get the economy going. Could you explain the differences between these two time periods? Thanks.
Right. This idea that, you know, Bush wanted to spend our way out of a recession, but now because we're apparently spending too much, we might end up in a recession?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that the difference is the fundamental nature of why we had a recession. So when you think about a typical recession, there are economic factors that cause the recession to happen. So let's think about, for example, like the 2008 financial crisis, right? Like that was a financial crisis that led to a housing crash, which then, of course, led to a general depletion of economic activity, because all of a sudden people had lost a bunch of wealth, people had lost their jobs, And so there was suddenly a massive hole in spending that the government sort of had to fill. This is the classic idea of how to respond to recessions. The government fills the hole of spending to get the economy churning again so that, you know, companies will rehire people that have lost their jobs and things, you know, you sort of jumpstart the economy so that it can start to run on its own again. But in COVID, we had a completely different situation where we had a recession basically because we shut everything down in order to stop a health crisis. So what was wrong actually had really nothing to do with the economy. And so, you know, part of the reason why there was so much spending early in COVID was basically because there was suddenly all of this economic activity that wasn't happening on purpose. And so the government was, you know, for example, paying people who were out of work because in some cases, we didn't want them to be working, right? Like, we wanted people to stay home and not spread the virus until we could get a vaccine. And so it was sort of like, you know, we were cryo-freezing the economy and then spending our way so that nothing would completely fall apart in the meantime. And then when the economy reopened, you know, it was really unclear the extent to which you needed to spend to sort of get back to that sort of, you know, jump-starting again, and to the extent to which the economy would sort of do that itself. And so, I don't know that I can – I don't know that there's a definitive answer yet. I think that maybe with a few years of hindsight, we'll be able to say whether the response was was accurate. But I think that we still had a lot of these, like, healthy, non-recessionary factors that were going on so that spending into it didn't really have the effect that you would normally expect from a recession.
Victoria Guida, she covers the Fed at Politico. Thank you very, very much. You've answered a bunch of my questions, but of course now I have like a million more, which means we'll just have to have you back sooner rather than later.
Victoria, thanks a bunch.
Sounds great. Thank you so
much. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.
There you go. Huh. Inflation in 20 minutes with Victoria Guida.
Yeah,
you know, it's funny. It gets wonky in a hurry, right? And
it really does.
It's tough to understand a lot of the levers and the actions and reactions and all that stuff. But it's so important because this is literally the thing driving the economy right now, and it's going to drive it for a little while yet to come. So I think we all need to understand it, which is why we talked to Victoria.
And what you said at the end there, I think, is particularly relevant: is that we're really not going to know how well the Fed navigated this until we can look back
exactly
on
right.
it
exactly
after
right.
yep. the stuff is already done.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely right.
Anyway, let us know what were you going to say, Kai?
No, that's exactly – I think you're exactly right. That's the key point of what you said.
Yeah. All right. So let us know what you think. How are you seeing inflation in your life? Hopefully you're in a position where you can manage it. Our number is 508-827-6278, also known as 508-UBSMART. You can also send us a voice memo, makemesmart@marketplace.org, and we will be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
News. Let's do it. You go first.
You Well, yours is about recession, so you should.
Oh,
go
that's
first.
That's true. That's true. That's true. So one of the things that a lot of Fed watchers have picked up on in Jay Powell's public pronouncements and others on the Board of Governors and the regional bank presidents is that they're really interested in protecting the unemployment rate. That is to say, not driving the unemployment rate up too much, while at the same time alleviating some of the wage pressures, if that makes any sense. So, because there are so many job openings. Bloomberg has a piece today. It's reported. It's not based on any official data source or a company survey, but they have done some calling around and they are finding out that the pace of job openings, and remember, we've talked about this on Marketplace a zillion times, right? It's the statistic that comes out called JOLTS, Job Opening and Labor Turnover Survey. The number of job openings in this economy has slowed in the last number of weeks as companies brace themselves for a possible economic slowdown. And that's one of the things that Rafael Bostic says a lot. He's the president of the Atlanta Fed. He says, look, we can protect the unemployment rate by bringing down the number of open jobs in this economy. That way, wages won't necessarily be hurt. People won't lose their jobs. But we will alleviate some of the pressure on the job market that is caused by so many job openings. And Bloomberg is reporting that today. And that's a big indicator, I think.
You said it's not going to hurt wages. I don't understand that.
Well, look, one of the things that's been happening in this economy is that workers are empowered by the number of job openings that are around. And workers, as we know, have done really well on wages, but they are not keeping up with inflation, especially at the lower end. So what's going to happen now is that by reducing somewhat, not entirely, but reducing somewhat the number of job openings, the overall wage pressure, right? Because what we're interested in here is, even though the economy is made up of people out there peopling, as I heard somebody say the other day, right? But it's the macro effect that we're interested in. So individually, workers will still have some power because there's going to be more than one job opening for each unemployed person. Macroeconomically, that's going to take some of the sting out. That's what's going to happen.
I guess I was confused because, like, if there are fewer job openings, that I would think gives workers less leverage to negotiate for higher wages for the jobs that they do take.
Say that again? I'm not sure I understood.
If there are fewer open jobs, because, you know, recession, the headline, recession-fearing bosses quietly abandon open jobs, then workers who are on the market no longer have as many people competing for their labor. And I would think that that would lower their ability to negotiate higher wages I'm confused.
I think individually workers will still maintain some power, not as much as they have, right? If all you have to do is look at the, you know, if you've got two job openings for every worker versus 1.5 job openings for every worker, those individual workers have less oomph. But it takes some of the sting out big picture wise on the wage pressure that is helping drive some of inflation, some. Not all, but some.
I see. So it helps inflation on the other side because since rising wages for workers also pushes up inflation because it's company costs. I got it.
There you go.
I gotcha.
Cool.
Okay. I have two, but I'm going to hit one of them really quick because it's just wild.
Crazy. It's just.
So in my beloved home state of Missouri, there is a candidate, I'm trying to remember, it's the former governor, Eric Greitens. He's running for Senate, and he put out this web ad that, you know, I was torn about whether to talk about this because you don't want to draw more attention to it because it's so awful, but on the other hand, you can't not talk about it. So basically, he put out a web ad on Monday literally encouraging people to hunt down Republicans who are insufficiently conservative. I'm reading here from St. Louis Public Radio story. I've watched the video. Facebook has taken it down because it violates the policies. Twitter is leaving it up because they think it's like, you know, I guess somehow in like part of the public debate. But in this video, he basically, and I'm sure he's claiming that it's, you know, a joke, but he's walking down a sidewalk, you know, with people in military uniforms saying that they're going like rhino hunting. Rhino is for Republicans in name only. And it is just the most like violence glorifying thing you've ever seen. And lots of people are responding in the GOP, as well as, you know, everyone just saying this is horrible, it's despicable, it's violent. Somebody was saying that, you know, they've contacted the Missouri Highway Patrol. And it really says something that, you know, we're in an environment where people feel like they can put these out. So,
The only thing I would add to that, which is an excellent summary of the case, is that you have to know a little bit of Greitens' history, right? He's a former Navy SEAL, elected governor of Missouri. While he was governor, he was accused of, credibly, by the way, entrapping a woman in a basement, tying her up, taking pictures of her, and then threatening to blackmail her. He's also been accused of spousal abuse. So there's a lot.
And child abuse.
There's a lot going on with Eric Greitens.
Yeah, and this is the candidate for Senate. One of them. Anyway, wild story. The other one, very quickly, because I know we got to get to the mailbag, is there's a really great New York Times video journalism project about surveillance in China and just how far the tech has evolved and just the scale of the surveillance state in China. And it's interesting, not just because, and important, not just because of what it means for the Chinese people, particularly those in the country who are being oppressed if they're, you know, ethnic minorities or something, but also a reminder that if this tech exists one place, it's available in other places, including here in the United States, and we have to be on our guard for this kind of stuff. So that's me.
For sure. Mailbag, let us do that.
Hi, Kai and Kimberly.
This is Godfrey from San Francisco.
Jesse from Charleston, South Carolina.
And I have a follow-up question.
It has me thinking and feeling a lot of things.
Okay, last week we asked you if you were watching the January 6th committee hearings, which I know both Kai and I are going to be doing as soon as we stop recording. And a couple of you called in with your thoughts.
Hi, this is Debbie from New Hampshire. I have family members who work on Capitol Hill, one of whom was directly impacted by the insurrection on the 6th. I can assure you it was no minor event. I remember vividly my phone blowing up that day, asking if this family member was safe. Many of the people that work on the Hill that you don't see who are behind the scenes are young people in their 20s and 30s. They don't get well compensated for what they do. In fact, they're working on Capitol Hill because they believe in public service and the government. I believe that it is very important that we find out the truth about what happened on January 6th. And thanks, as always, for making me smarter.
I'm sure, Kimberly, you know some people in D.C. who were there that day, right?
So many people. Yeah. And then whenever I'm going up to the Hill for reporting, you know, I always ask, you know, the congressional aides, like, how they're holding up. And they're telling me they've got, you know, some mental health care that, that the staff is being provided. But also, years ago, I did a story about the people who work turning over the offices and do, like, the carpets and the tapestries and
furniture people.
The furniture people, and they have. I loved that story, and I love those guys. It was all guys. They're like in the basement of these office buildings on the Hill. And one thing that folks may not realize, but this happened just as they were in the process of refreshing and turning over all the offices for new members of Congress. So these folks had just finished. I mean, and this sounds minor, but they put so much care into maintaining these antiques and this historical building and like restuffing chairs. And they had just finished getting all these offices and things ready for, you know, Congress to come back. And then just to see it trashed, that was just like another. And I called to check on them the next day, and they were all traumatized. Anyway.
Yeah. All right, change of gears here. We had a conversation last week about the metric system, and here is what Deborah in Maryland had to say about a way to remember Celsius temperatures if you have spent your life, as most of us have, trying to understand Fahrenheit.
Celsius for temperature, 30's hot, 20's nice, 10's chilly, 0's ice. Just thought I'd share. Guys, you make me smart. Thank you. Bye.
Simple rules of thumb are the best. That's all I'm
saying. That's helpful. So, 30's hot, 20's nice, 10's chilly, 0's ice. Got it. That's a good one. All right. Before we go, we're going to leave you with this week's answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is, what is something you thought you knew, but later found out you were wrong about? This answer today comes from Alexander Howard, director of the Digital for Democracy Project and a recent guest on Marketplace Tech.
I thought that when we as Americans were confronted with an existential threat to our democracy, that would lead us to be united against a shared enemy. And that the enemy wouldn't be one another. The hardest thing for me has been seeing that our shared commitment to democracy is a lot more fragile than I think I had wanted it to be. And I'm hopeful that there will be people across the different institutions, frankly, that the young folks of the world who want better for their children than what we've been given. But I'm not certain anymore that that's going to happen in anytime soon. It certainly won't unless we make some significant adjustments to how every major institution is engaging and informing, educating Americans.
Amen.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep, yep. We're just going to let that one sit there. Send us your answers, would you, via voice memo to our email at makemesmart@marketplace.org, or leave us a message 508-827-6278. You can send us your answers, your questions, your comments, whatever you like. 508-UB-SMART is an easy way to remember that.
All the memorization devices.
I know, right? I didn't know there was going to be a test on this part.
Make Me Smart is directed and produced by Marissa Cabrera. Olivia Zhao is our intern. Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletter.
Well, Carlos Dorado is on the other side of the soundproof glass today. Charlton Thorpe's going to come in at some point today, I guess, and mix it down. I don't know, maybe. Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez compose our theme music. The senior producer is Bridget Bonner. Donna Tam is the director of On Demand. And Marketplace's vice president and general manager is Neil Scarborough. No, Charlton works hard all the time. All the time.
All the time.
All the time. Just does it very quietly.
Very quietly.
That's right.
You never even know he's there.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.